You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio, 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, June 21st, 2018.
So really, when we see those surrenders, while they're scary, there's no real public health there.
As Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill continues his public attacks on needle exchange programs, the Indiana Recovery Alliance celebrates reversing over 2,000 overdoses. We'll hear from Indiana Recovery Alliance founder and director Chris Abert in today's feature report.
Yesterday afternoon, President Donald Trump signed an executive order instructing immigration officials to keep migrant families together when they're detained. Our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks area residents how they feel about the immigration debate as it plays out on the U.S.-Mexico border. That's coming up later in the program, but first, your daily headlines.
Indiana will be seeing a 1 cent per gallon gas tax increase starting on July 1st. The increase passed the Indiana General Assembly last year as part of a bill that will increase funding for state road construction and maintenance projects. The 1 cent increase is designed to account for monetary inflation and will continue each year through 2024. The 1 cent per year increase was a smaller section of a bill that bumped the state's 18 cent per gallon gas tax to 28 cents per gallon. According to the Associated Press, the increase will generate $31 million annually for the state. The tax increase is coming just as Indiana is starting to see jumps in prices at the pump. According to the American Automobile Association, the average price for gas per gallon in the state is currently at $2.88, compared with $2.09 at this time last year.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb met with Vice President Pence in Washington yesterday. Holcomb was in Washington for the Select USA Summit that aims to promote foreign investment in the United States. Pence's lieutenant governor during the vice president's tenure, Holcomb was sworn in March of 2016, replacing former lieutenant governor Sue Ellspermann. Pence later dropped out of the 2016 gubernatorial election to run for vice president, leaving Holcomb to run in his place. In a statement yesterday, Governor Holcomb said he and Pence spoke about employment and his concerns about the impacts of trade tariffs on Indiana businesses. Holcomb wrote, quote, "I was encouraged by the vice president's comments about the progress that has been made in negotiating reciprocal trade agreements with our partners, especially relating to agriculture and manufacturing," unquote. Governor Holcomb also expressed his support for President Trump's executive order to put a halt to family separation at the border. Holcomb further called on both sides of the congressional aisle to take immediate action on immigration reform.
Bloomington's 2nd Street overpass will be open to four lanes of traffic this weekend for the Monroe County Fair. The four lanes will be opened at 4 p.m. on this Saturday. The Monroe County Fair lasts from Saturday, June 30th through Sunday, July 8th. The 2nd Street Bridge will be open to four lanes of traffic for 2 weeks until July 7th. The announcement comes just a day after the city reopened Country Club between Rogers and Walnut Streets. The Indiana Department of Transportation is aiming to get the Interstate 69 Section 5 corridor from Bloomington to Martinsville completed before their August deadline.
The Bloomington City Council is poised to pass legislation limiting the use of recently purchased Lenco Bearcat armored truck. In their meeting last night, council members agreed on the need to codify language that would ensure how the vehicle would be used, regardless of changes in city administration. Council member Andy Ruff introduced the proposed legislation.
So between BPD, the administration, the council members, and the community, it was agreed upon that there really should be some policy that was strong enough to guarantee, to assure that in the future, with a different council and a different scenario, a different city government potentially, that the use of the vehicle is comfortable as we might be with it, and the current administration and the current police chief, we would want to put something in place that, in order to be changed in any significant way or overturned in any way, would require a full, thorough public process that included the council up front.
City Clerk Nicole Bolden read the prohibitions outlined in the proposed legislation for the public.
A critical incident response team armored rescue vehicle shall not be used in the following manner. 1, for the purpose of crowd control, and 2, during nonviolent public demonstrations. B, prohibited equipment. The following equipment is prohibited for use on the critical incident response team armored rescue vehicle. 1, affixed firearms, 2, water cannons, and 3, any other affixed device capable of launching or fixing a projectile.
During deliberation, Councilmember Andy Ruff brought up the community members' concerns about the militarization of the local police force and research on the development of an attack mentality in local law enforcement.
In my reading on the issue, the linkage that researchers were trying to establish or seemed to sort of hang the connection on is that with militarized equipment, it required military training. Well, I can actually read from one of the quotes from one of the papers. Military equipment naturally increases military-style training for said equipment. That training can increase the other dimensions of militarization inside the law enforcement agency. So I would like to ask you how BPD is going to prevent that. I know you've said that this vehicle doesn't require any specialized training. So how do you keep this from happening?
So let's, what I first want to do is I want to compare what we're buying versus an MRAP, which is a military vehicle. The military vehicle would require additional training because it's built to military specifications. It has a different electrical system. It's just built differently than a commercial vehicle. So that's the first thing. This is basically a Ford F-550 truck, which the city has several of in the fleet. It just has an armored box on the back to protect the occupants. So it doesn't require any additional training. As far as military training, the critical incident response team, they train in tactics that involve active shooters, in rescue situations, hostage situations, things like that. You know, I'm not that up on military training. I'm assuming that the military probably does some of that training also. But ours, our training is based in state statute, in laws that are applicable to the state of Indiana. We train with police equipment. So what training we do is nationally recognized tactical training for situations that we might respond to, which would be the active shooters, the hostage situations, barricaded subjects, things like that. The military, I would assume, would train differently than that. They also have access to probably weapons and equipment that we don't use, that we don't have. And so I'm going to guess that their training is going to be different than that, too. So, you know, military units have done law enforcement training because they deal more in urban situations, too. But it's different because they are in foreign countries that don't have the laws that apply to us. All of our training is based in civilian law enforcement tactics that state laws apply to.
Chairman Chris Sturbaum asked Chief Dekoff about transparency. According to Dekoff, the BPD reports monthly to the city's Board of Public Safety and other organizations.
Once the vehicle is in place, we will start reporting CERT team data to them also, so that'll be an additional report. But they ask for things such as the number of arrests we've had, the number of calls we have, just basic general information like that. We also quarterly report. I think we're up to 13 or 14 different data sets to the Be Clear portal, which is on the city's website, and we also report data to the to a national database. It's the Police Data Initiative, which was a spinoff from the 21st Century Policing Report. And I think there are 150 agencies across the country that report data to that.
Dekoff says BPD also reports use of force data on a quarterly basis to the city's Be Clear data portal and the National Police Data Initiative website. He assured council member Isabel Piedmont-Smith that the race of the individuals involved in an incident is included in the data. Dekoff said later he didn't want the vehicle to be a mystery and that BPD may bring it out at educational events.
You know, I understand people's concern that we don't want to normalize it, but I also think that if people see it, they're not gonna see this war machine that's got guns mounted on it that we're gonna drive around. It's a protection vehicle for the officers and whoever they might have to go rescue.
Before the council's vote, Chairman Sturbaum called for public comment, but there was none. Piedmont Smith responded.
I really want to express my disappointment that there's not a single member of the public speaking today. With the furor that we endured in February and March and into April about this vehicle, and, you know, sharing concerns that some of us also up here had about the process. I've posted this on my Facebook page. I've told the people who were leaders of the Black Lives Matter group and other concerned groups. And the fact that there's nobody here dismays me.
Councilmember Jim Sims noted that a few audience members, whom he referred to as social justice warriors, were made aware that they could speak to the issue, but had to leave due to a scheduling conflict.
There were many folks, or not many, but several folks in opposition, and many of us have talked with them and have all those fears been allayed? No. But I think that they are more comfortable with some of the issues that we had at the beginning. So I don't want anyone to think that we're moving forward without their input, because we have.
And here's Council Member Susan Sandberg.
Bloomington is not, has not, and will not become a community where we have to fear our police.
The council gave the proposed legislation a unanimous do-pass recommendation. The council is expected to take a formal vote in its June 27th meeting. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Slotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or online at slotographlegal.com. Slotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill continued his attack on needle exchanges throughout the state yesterday. Hill released a statement following an overdose death in Richmond, Indiana, in which a needle from a needle exchange was used. In his statement, the attorney general wrote, quote, "While we should always work to mitigate risks of contracting contagious diseases, we must focus greater attention on helping these individuals overcome the root problems of substance abuse and addiction," unquote. Hill has repeatedly come out against allowing needle exchanges to operate in the state. In today's feature report, WFHB correspondent Francis Sheets speaks with Indiana Recovery Alliance founder Chris Abert.
So the way it works is that people come in and they get connected to services that if they were otherwise not connected to would leave them prone to transmission of HIV, hepatitis C, abscesses, endocarditis, and fatal overdose, not to mention general disconnection from any services. John Hopkins did a study that showed 80% of the people in the opioid crisis right now were not connected to treatment services. We're talking about the vast majority of people who are currently suffering in this epidemic.
Do these needle exchanges, in your experience, encourage increased criminality in the people that are utilizing them?
Attorney General Curtis Hill framed this in his experience. And we're not really interested in anybody's experience. We're interested in data and research, particularly peer-reviewed research. So there's a preponderance of evidence that these programs are wildly effective. In fact, you'll be hard-pressed to find negative consequences in peer-reviewed literature from search service programs and other harm reduction programs. I would just think it's disingenuous for him to phrase these things within, you know, his experience or other people's specific experience with anecdote, because even if you have multiple anecdotes, the plural of that isn't data. We're really interested in evidence-based, compassionate responses to this syndemic. And by syndemic, I mean involving more than just overdose and opiates. It also involves HIV and hepatitis C.
Curtis Hill wrote this op-ed piece about needle exchange programs in which he includes a quote from the Madison County prosecutor that says that these needle exchange programs come with a lot of risks and that they, quote, leave thousands of needles on the streets, in our parks, and on our street corners, and our parking lots, and our community. Do you think that these programs are generating a mass amount of needles being left in public areas?
So listeners know, between 2004 and 2014, we've seen an increase in admitted IV drug use among 18 to 28-year-olds. The increase, 600%. This is before syringe exchange or any syringe service programs were made available. Then, as a result of more syringes being found in 2014 and previously, our legislator, actually, when they rewrote the criminal code, moved the charge for possession of a syringe to a felony in hopes that less people would carry those. So the problem of improperly disposed syringes is not new. It is not caused by syringe service programs. It's well documented by legislative action in 2014 that it was a problem. And then the data, again, showing 600% increase, shows that this problem existed well before responses to the problem. The other thing I would point out, and this is also really good for people to know, is the actual danger from a community-found syringe. So you're walking down the street and you see a syringe on the ground. The danger from that, according to the British Medical Journal, is practically negligible. They also have articles from the Journal of Public Health that show that there's never been a case of HIV transmission from a community-found syringe. So really, when we see those syringes, while they're scary, there's no real public health risk. Now, if we juxtapose that with the very real public health risk of people sharing syringes, using them when they're pushed into the shadows and exposing each other, you know, that is actual, and that has led to the current hepatitis C epidemic. It led directly to the largest HIV outbreak in the history of the country, about an hour south of us in Scott County. And that's irrefutable evidence. So again, this is more like fear-mongering based on no actual evidence of what the danger is. So what's unacceptable is to continue to allow people to be exposed to these diseases and to be pushed into the shadows and sometimes literally die alone as a result of continued criminalization and propaganda such as this.
Can you give me a little bit of statistics or data on people using clean needles versus dirty needles when these exchange programs are offered?
Absolutely. So again, there's 30 years of data and research, and what it shows is anywhere from 75 to 80% decrease in HIV transmission and hepatitis C transmission. The caveat is that the syringe service programs don't act alone. We also have to have services such as medication-assisted therapies like buprenorphine, also known as Suboxone, and methadone available. We have those in our community, and we need those across the state in order to be effective. But again, the research is clear and conclusive that these absolutely decrease sharing and decrease. What actually increases sharing is not allowing people access to those syringes, right? Which is what Attorney General Curtis Hill is suggesting, stopping allowing access. He's hoping to achieve another Scott County type HIV outbreak or just a fly in the face of the rest of not only Republican leaders in Indiana, but the public health community, doctors, American Medical Association, World Health Organization, SAMHSA. Can't think of an organization that's on the forefront of the current opioid crisis that couldn't disagree more with this kind of anomaly and outlier in our political system right now, Attorney General Curtis Hill.
So one of the main things that Curtis Hill is saying is that he thinks that using these needle share programs are not encouraging people to overcome their substance abuse problem, but simply encouraging them to do it, maybe possibly more safely. He doesn't seem convinced by the safety part. What would you say is the best implementation of services to help people not only do it more safely, but also maybe overcome substance abuse issues or stop using intravenous drugs?
Sure. Well, we don't want anybody left to suffer in chaotic drug use. I think we're all on the same page with that. You know, where we differ is, again, with evidence. So as I cited earlier, that John Hopkins study that showed 80% of people were not currently engaged in treatment. That treatment often isn't a magic bullet. So what we want to do, and again, what we've been shown to do, is link people to life-saving services first and foremost. We want to make sure that they feel connected in meaningful ways, which is often impossible. People are continuing to use drugs. Again, there's more data. A simple data Google search will show this. It shows that if there's a syringe service program in town, people are 5 times more likely to seek treatment. So uninformed opinion, as though he's an expert in the field, is quite frankly very, very damaging. And when we say stigmatization and criminalization means a death for the people that we love and care about, I'm talking specifically about this type of rhetoric. So clearly Curtis Hill is a law and order candidate. He shows very little compassion for people who are suffering in this epidemic, and I don't understand what exactly his plan is. I do know that his chief deputy was in the New York Times for sending more people to prison than the entire city of San Francisco. So the chief deputy, Aaron Meggengard, he came out of Dearborn County, and that county, again, is renowned throughout the country for simply sending people off to jail.
Is there anything else on this topic that you think is important?
Well, I'll leave listeners with this. You know, since we've started, if you look at statewide overdose statistics, Monroe County has been one of the very few counties to not have increase in fatal overdose. It could most assuredly be just because of the tens of thousands of doses of naloxone that we've been able to distribute through our syringe service program. So it's not just syringes in these programs. It's, again, access to life-saving medications such as naloxone, the opiate overdose reversal drug. It's meaningful connection. It's 5 times more likely to access treatment. So less syringes on the street. More public education, you know, about the safety of those syringes as well as the real dangers of this endemic that we're facing. So, you know, I know that where we live now, public servants tend to be much more focused on compassionate, evident responses to this problem. So I'm grateful. The last Attorney General, Greg Zeller, was very compassionate and understanding in this issue. And he actually gave hundreds of thousands of dollars for naloxone to be distributed throughout the state, a policy which Curtis Hill reversed. So we're hoping that either Curtis Hill reverses policy and his thinking on this issue and opens himself up to be educated, as opposed to perhaps willfully ignorant at this point. And we also hope that if he doesn't, that we will get public servants that are willing to do that.
And that was Indiana Recovery Alliance founder Chris Abert speaking with WFHB correspondent Francis Sheets about the role of needle exchanges in Indiana. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Support also comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
Yesterday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order
directing immigration agencies to actively work to keep would-be immigrant families together. The order comes amid public backlash over a decision by Attorney General Jeff Sessions in April ordering a zero-tolerance approach to immigration. Public outrage reached a peak this week when images and audio of children in holding cells was released by the media. Voices in the Streets asks Bloomington residents their opinion on the zero-tolerance immigration policy and Trump's executive order.
Well, it's completely appalling, and it's a catastrophe.
It's pretty awful. I mean, the kids don't know where their parents are. The parents know where the kids are.
I think the backlash started happening around May or so, and it was so horrific. And I feel like we say this after every crazy thing that comes from this administration, but it was so horrific that I couldn't even believe it, and I didn't even know which sources I could go to. It's heartbreaking, but at the same time, there's been so much heartbreak that it's hard to swim out of this, like, what can I do?
It would be such a struggle and a hardship to come over to our country. These people have no warning that their kids are going to be separated from them, and I just can't imagine the emotional pain that these parents and kids are going through.
No, I mean, it's like the old cliches, like, we're all immigrants, and I think there's enough for everybody, you know, and I think we should make enough for everyone, you know. So yeah, I think it's horrible and really sad.
I think it's wrong, 100% wrong.
I think he is using it as leverage, but just in an utterly real politic and appalling way.
Yeah, it's hostile and inhumane. I mean, we're a country of immigrants. The white man is just afraid because pretty soon he's going to be outnumbered. And I just think we're seeing this huge fear-based kind of, you know, state. It's always also not only been a country of immigrants, but a country that's just continually ostracized anybody that's different racially or you know, even economically different.
The reason why he signed the bill is because at the end of the day, he lives for ratings. Like a 15-year-old girl, he feels bad about himself, and so he tries to make the ratings better. And that, unfortunately, is the only way he will physically move things, in my opinion, which is very sad because this, it's bringing up imagery of Holocaust. It's bringing up imagery of this, that, and the other.
Well, I think it's the backlash. I think he responds to the public. I don't think he has a lot of strong opinions, unless it's for himself.
I'm actually a fourth-generation immigrant. I'm an international student here, and I feel like a lot of people really underestimate how difficult it is to quote-unquote legally immigrate to the United States. Looking at the way that this country started, immigration should be more open. The system should be able to be fixed in certain ways. It seems very absurd to me that one would have to sign a bill that makes sure that families stay together, because that should be a given. Like, we should not be seeing images of children in cages, because it evokes a lot of images of the Holocaust, of like internment in the United States, slavery in the United States. I think what has been positive, though, is seeing how many people have come out in support of immigrants. Because of all of the negative rhetoric I see, it's very refreshing to see, especially Americans, especially white Americans, be like, hey, no, we need to stop this. I've been seeing posts by my professors on Facebook, and that's been really, like, it's made me feel much more welcome. I definitely think that he signed it because a lot of things that he does is based on how other people perceive him. At the end of the day, if the backlash can get him to sign a bill that will keep children safe, it's not ideal, but it is what it is. And I would rather children be safe than them be in cages.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Francis Sheets and Jonah Chester, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Francis Sheets.
Voices in the Street was produced by Jenna Janikowski. Our engineer today is Wes Martin. Our theme music was provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer, Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glab, a WFHB news and public affairs program highlighting the issues, events, and people in South Central Indiana. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.